Unitarian Universalist ministers have this way of finding out about one another through a rather obvious but still subtle exchange of questions. The expected ones are which seminary someone attended. In that quick exchange, you might be surprised to know that you can make some pretty good assumptions about theology, attention to justice, born and raised UU or a come-inner, second career minister or called early. You get the picture all through that one question. But there are other questions too. Size of the congregation one serves, size of staff. But most interesting, and most often most telling, do you still have joys and sorrows? Now, I want to pause here and say this is not a sermon on introducing a change for UUCWC regarding this ritual. Those of you with your backs erect, please stay with me. And those of you with anticipation and readiness for a change, it won't be today. This is how the question is asked. Do you still have joys and sorrows? Oh, yes, some say proudly. Others share the same words, but with a tone of defeat. It is a rather messy portion of our hour together. And by messy, I mean that sometimes the microphone goes in and out or isn't held properly. Sometimes folks take longer than expected to speak. Sometimes we say things we would have said differently had we been more guarded, less vulnerable, more of who we like to show the world. But messy more so because the heart gets pulled from the elation dance of new babies or marriages, anniversaries, days or years sober, clean bills of health, to the deflation, the heaviness, the cradling of that same heart who hears of another unfair, unjust diagnosis, a desperation that someone will come to safety, a death too early. Many don't know how to move with the arrhythmia of it all. I remember my first days in this pulpit when someone shared with me how Charles learned how to cut his sermon depending on how long the ritual lasted. I would learn, this person assured me, and I smiled, hearing the priority of an hour-long service over making room for however long we needed to be together. It's messy, because the ritual of joys and sorrows is a hyper-focused illustration of the spirit, the breath of life, of how at any moment there are celebrations and sorrows waiting for each of us, waiting to bombard the monotony of our days and interrupt the routines we've so wonderfully crafted. The Sufi mystic Rumi and his often recited guest house, of course, comes to mind. We heard it last week as the opening words, and again this week as a reading. This being human is a guest house, he says, and continues to take us through the worst visitors we could imagine, and worse yet, a celebration of them. It is a beautiful poem. There is a reason it is often how people know of Rumi. But let's break it down for a minute. This being human is a guest house. The thing that we inhabit, this body of flesh and bone that you and I have crafted and worn, is not our own, but is a thing borrowed, to be returned. To the earth, to the universe, it is not ours for the keeping. And every morning, a new arrival. A world out there that we wake to day in and out, lucky enough for this to be true, and yet a lot out of our control. Every morning, a new arrival for us to receive, regardless of our expectations, our hopes, our plans. A joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. the spirit, the breath of life. Welcome and entertain them all, Rumi says. You can't see it, but there is an exclamation mark after that line. Don't just hold the door open to whatever may come our way, but entertain, make space, make food, make them laugh, ask questions, make of that joy, depression, that meanness, that awareness, a friend. Even if they are a crowd of sorrows, a crowd, he says, a room full of one hard thing after another, a crowd who violently sweeps your house, the place where you feel secure, where you are accepted, where you know who you are, empty it of its furniture, all the comforts you know. Still, treat each guest honorably as if there is a violence, a wound in your care. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. It is here I pause each time, as if Rumi's charges aren't hard enough. He then has the audacity to make this about me, about you. What has been avoided, door slammed shut in fear, turned away in anxiety, hidden because it is unknown, uncomfortable, uncontrolled, that has taken up room in my being, that has filled me with life's false comforts, that has made me inhospitable to my own joy, my own growing. And then it concludes. The dark thought, the shame, the malice. Meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whatever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. Last Sunday, I held the Roots class for some of our newcomers, the introduction to Unitarian Universalism. And so, of course, we spent a little time talking about our principles. It led to this wonderful conversation about, in my own words, the threats or the dangers of the first principle, the inherent worth and dignity of all people. How do we treat one another with dignity, with worth, when they don't do the same, someone asked. The newcomer beautifully said, when they don't see me as a person. Rumi's poem is not about placing our health, hearts, spirits on the line in the path of violence. It is not about sacrificing ourselves because we can learn something in the suffering. There is no guide who will lead us into some path of pain for kicks and giggles, for learning or growth. And the same is true of the first principle. It is not a charge to engage in relationships, maintain relationships that will harm you. You also have inherent worth and deserve to be treated with dignity. You are not without the need to be affirmed, respected, shown that sacred promise that reminds you of your inherent wholeness, a place we all may need to work to get back to. But there are questions in both Rumi's poem and our first principle. Namely, in what way do we engage in life's uncertainties, in life's crowd of sorrows? How do we invite them in, make room for, look at long enough, forget for a moment the people out there, but the personalities within, the dark thought, the shame, the malice within, that we're so good at judging, at protecting, at turning away from? A colleague of mine writes, there's a phenomenon in psychology known as the secondary symptom, such as secondary anxiety or secondary depression. This is expressed as, oh my God, I'm anxious, or oh God, I'm depressed. Essentially, this is panic. Rather than bowing to the visitor and beginning a conversation, one dashes around screaming, compounding the suffering which visits with useless fear, he says. On this last Sunday, in which I will share with you the theme of hospitality and where it has led me, I offer that it is this conversation that I am drawn to, a conversation with my shame, my malice, my dark thoughts, a parenting, a protecting of the emotions and fears that are my own. Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again. It is the theology of Simon and Garfunkel. A life cannot be written nor predetermined. Even an hour-long, or a bit longer than that, worship service can't be crafted well enough to make sure we all experience, feel, or think a particular way, or leave at a particular time. But we can make spaces in our lives, just as we do in our communities, in which we leave room for, in which we invite in all the joys and sorrows, those unexpected visitors to speak, to be acknowledged, to move in our midst as we move, in brave ways, in honest ways, in hopes that it leads towards something more honest and true. Now, let me end by saying something really clear, as if you don't know this already. I am a control freak. I am a descendant of the Unitarian part of us who prioritized reason and the idea that we could craft ourselves into better being, salvation by character, discipline, the whole thing. The irony in this conversation for me is how terrifying it is. The idea of making room for my terror. The idea of laughing in humble and accepting acknowledgement of my discomforts. I often wonder when I will learn the craft of cutting down my sermon so I can get you out on time when joys and sorrows go so long. But I want to learn how to bow to what is. Not as some subservient, without agency, non-actor in my own life, my religion, and North American culture would never allow for such a thing, but bow with respect for how large and fluid this life is, the interdependence of this life of which we are but a part. I want to learn to be in conversation with the parts of me that scare me, that disappoint, that feel so far from that wholeness that I know I once was. For I no longer want to risk being separate from myself, from the world that offers itself, from the spirit of life that I, that we are. This is only a guest house. A messy, beautiful, hard, worthy, good guest house. And one day it will go back to where it came. And so I pray ours each houses a life that risks the rigor of hospitality, of conversation with all that is ours. I leave you with this one last thought. At the close of the foreword to his book, Jack Kornfield, an American Buddhist master, writes, "Someone has said, if you're going to practice forgiveness, start with something less than the Holocaust." If we are going to practice bowing to all that visits, it is good to start with small things, bowing to what annoys and irritates and disappoints us, and practicing the bow until our welcome can embrace more and more of all life's shapes and forms, lights and shadows, pain and peace. May it be so.